This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll take a look at the epidemic of police violence in the United States and see what New York State is doing about it.
Heidi wrote an article for the Brooklyn newspaper Independent that lays out various ways to fight police abuse, and we're going to talk about that.
We'll remember the life of crusading and courageous publisher Ellen Ray.
A journalist before Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, she took on the national security establishment for 27 years.
We'll hear a recent talk from our own Michael Smith at the Socialism 2015 conference in Chicago.
The tactics of the United States with respect to Cuba have changed, but the strategy to return Cuba into the orbit of international capitalism still persists.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Mustey Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Heidi Boghossian, you wrote an excellent lead article on criminal justice in the August issue of The Independent. That's the Brooklyn, New York radical newspaper. And the headline is, "Prevent Police Killings Before They Happen. More Prosecutions Won't Address Underlying Problems." And I wanted to ask you about the article. You start off indicating that there's been an epidemic of police killings lately. Could you expand upon what you mean by epidemic?
Michael, the rash of police killings that has been covered in the media over the last year, especially of African-American men, isn't really anything new in our society. What's new is the fact that we have a lot of individual citizens with iPhones and other ways to document these incidents, bringing them forth into the public arena. But we definitely have a movement, along with Black Lives Matter and other protest movements across the nation, that have brought to the fore the fact that despite the number of police killings of civilians, including unarmed civilians, we rarely have prosecution of police officers.
Why is that?
It's because of the very close relationship that law enforcement has with district attorneys. The district attorneys rely on police for things like gathering evidence, getting witnesses to present their cases. So they're not going to want to give evidence to bring those officers to justice. It destroys their very intimate working relationship on a daily basis.
But what about a bureaucratic solution to that problem, the one that Governor Cuomo in New York proposed, taking the prosecution out of the hands, say, with respect to Eric Gardner, who was murdered in Staten Island, taking the prosecution out of the hands of the locals in Staten Island and giving it to, as Cuomo has done, Eric Schneiderman, the New York State Attorney General, and making him a special prosecutor. How do you feel about that reform?
Well, that was done by executive order. It's going to last a year, could possibly be extended for a second year. It's a good start, and certainly it will make the families of victims of police killings feel a bit more confident that Cuomo and the state is trying to address this. However, what I said in the article was that going back to the 1994 report of the Mullen Commission, which you'll remember was formed to investigate police corruption in the New York Police Department, as well as brutality, they actually looked into having a special prosecutor and said that it was a tough-sounding idea that won't solve the problem. And that's because no matter who's bringing a prosecution against a police officer, they're notoriously difficult to obtain a conviction at trial. We know through especially the National Lawyers Guild and its Police Accountability Project that in the very few instances where a police officer is brought to justice, it's usually through civil litigation and settlements, so that after a criminal trial which fails, a civil case will be brought. And what happens, we saw this with the cases against protesters at the RNC here in 2004, is it ends up costing the city millions of dollars when they in that case, engaged in false arrests of hundreds, if not thousands, of protesters. So in the case of a killing, there may be justice, but, you know, it's brought by private lawyers and not by the state.
Yeah, the city pays out all this money, which is essentially our money, and then it continues on again. You know, so it's really no solution at all.
Although I must say that in certain civil cases, Michael, as you know, and the really good cases are when, in addition to a financial settlement, some kind of policy change is built into the terms of the agreement. So that, for example, police officers may have to institute a certain kind of sensitivity training or keep records that they're not keeping, things like that. Or in some cases, they'll have an independent monitor or a consent decree where the police department is actually under the purview of either the federal government or, you know, an independent monitor. But what I also argue for, Michael, is that we have to have changes in the way officers are trained, accountability, really kind of fundamental changes in how officers deal with the public. We see far too often a police officer gets insulted and turns angry and overreacts. And oftentimes that's young officers who are really green to the job and don't have that ability to step back and not respond.
Judge Bruce Wright, who was a criminal court judge here in New York for years, had a really important suggestion, and that these guys, when they're screened, should be examined for their ability to not feel threatened and overreact. It's a psychological thing. And in my experience, every police brutality case that I've handled has been, you know, cops having their authority threatened and overreacting.
And we're seeing that, Michael, in a lot of the videos that are coming out where, for example, in that traffic stop where the woman later committed, or they said she committed suicide, but it was the officer really feeling disrespected. Because
she was smoking a cigarette after he busted her
for doing
on a
nothing.
BS charge of switching lanes. I think he was harassing her to begin with. You know, exactly. It's that type of character that should never be allowed into the police department. It should be weeded out.
And Michael, just on a side note, because another area where we see this kind of really, I think, lack of training and accountability is in the so-called private police, where you have security officers who are hired at very low hourly wages. They're not trained, or they may receive, you know, under 10 hours of training. Some of them are armed, and they really don't have the kind of supervision and ongoing training that is so essential for individuals in a position of authority that's dealing with the public. But of course, we expect more from the public police in that. But
whether
I think we're seeing the same.
Pay for the cop.
And we're starting to see that in our municipal police officers, same kind of poor training and failure to supervise.
Well, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights in 1981, as you point out, issued a report that said quite an extraordinary thing. They talked about community control of the police. And I remember that was the demand of the movement back in the 60s, black control of the black community. I think that is such a radical demand. If you have a community board with subpoena power over these cops, we could win some of these other reforms that we've been talking about, and we should fight for them. But this one, this is the deal breaker with these people, because in reality, the police are the armed force of the 1%. On the one hand, they go out there and they'll hassle a panhandler or whatever minor crime you might ask them to do something about. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But at the end of the day, you know, they're on horses. They share offices with the bankers on Wall Street during Occupy, and they're there to protect the 1%.
And they also share surveillance and personal information that they collect about individuals between the public and the private sectors. But I want to mention, Michael, that here in New York, as I'm sure our listeners will know, we have the Civilian Complaint Review Board. And the problem is, and I think we're making some inroads in trying to make it more effective, but the problem is, as usual, you have the police union, you have arguments that there have to be police officers on what is supposed to be an independent oversight body, it's always difficult to really have a community-led monitoring agency due to the politics. As you say, yeah. they're ingrained with protecting the 1%.
I mean, the Civilian Complaint Board, you really can't take them seriously here. For one thing, if they do something good, the police commissioner can override it. But my own personal experience with them, years ago, I saw them putting a young black kid into the backseat of a police car. What they're supposed to do is put their hand on the person's head and guide them in so they don't bang their head on the top of the door frame. And these cops just pushed the kid in intentionally so that he'd smash his head against the steel door frame. So I went over and I took the name of the cop and his badge number, and I called up the Civilian Complaint Review Board and I made a complaint.
And what happened?
6 months later, I called them back because I hadn't heard anything from them, and they told me they had dismissed the complaint. And I said, why? And they said, because we didn't have any credible witnesses.
Well, I filed a similar complaint. I was at the 14th Street subway station a couple of years ago, and I saw a canine unit with his handler holding him about a foot in front of an African-American man who was backed up against the wall. And the officer was letting the dog, or I don't know if it's letting or if they call it ordering, but the dog was barking in a really ferocious way right into this person in the middle of rush hour, you know, right in 14th Street, subway station downstairs. So I complained about that. And again, same thing, 6 months later, I cut a bogus letter responding. The problem is, Florence Finkel used to be the executive director, and she was pushed out by the union head of the I think it was Norman Seabrook of the corrections union, mounted pressure to get her fired. So no matter how what kind of quality people you have in that position, highly political.
These police unions are rich, they're strong, they're nationally coordinated, they play a political role on the national, state, and local level, and politicians are going to consider that when they try to go up against them, if they dare to do it. For listeners who want to check out Heidi's entire article or check out The Independent, it's online at independent.org. That's Indy, I-N-D-Y, pendant, and we'll link to it on lawanddisorder.org.
Michael Smith, we both attended what I thought was a really uplifting memorial service recently for Ellen Ray.
Complete with a New Orleans jazz brass band that played both a processional and a recessional, because Ellen went down to New Orleans a lot. She had a contact with that city, which I'll talk about in a minute. But yes, indeed, we had that at St. Mark's Church on August 20th.
And you gave what I thought were great remarks that really talked about her political work.
Michael Ratner and Karen Ranucci wrote an obituary for the Indy that went out across the country online. And they said she was like WikiLeaks and Julian Assange before the wide use of computers. And indeed she was. The kind of courageous journalism that she pursued and the information that she got out on the secret police was extraordinary. You know, for 27 years, month after month, she and her husband Bill Schaap edited the Covert Action Information Bulletin.
Which then turned into Covert Action Quarterly.
Covert Action Quarterly, which I read, I think you read.
Yes.
And they named names. You know, the CIA, let me just back up for a second and talk about what the CIA became and then what Ellen did courageously in the face of it. The CIA was formed in 1947 to gather intelligence because the United States was unaware of what the Japanese were planning when they bombed the naval base in Hawaii called Pearl Harbor in 1941. So 6 years later, after the Second World War, the CIA was formed to provide intelligence for the executive, and that's all it was supposed to do. Within a year. Foreign intelligence, right. A good point. But within a year, it was converted into a paramilitary organization, given the green light to do all kinds of illegal things, like the overthrow of foreign governments, assassinations. With respect to assassinations, between 1948 and 1967 when they assassinated Che Guevara. You know, the difference between an assassination and a murder is
assassination. Assassination is political.
A political, right. Political murder. And they had attempted or succeeded in assassinating 19 leaders of foreign countries. The CIA overthrew the governments of Vietnam, Bolivia, Indonesia, Guatemala, Iran, and most famously, 1971, the government of Allende in Chile, where Kissinger, the Secretary of State, said no country has a right to become socialist. So the CIA was doing all this stuff, and Ellen Ray took them on. She and Bill Shapp and Lew Wolf, they could figure out who the CIA agents were in foreign countries, and they published their names. Well, this led Congress to pass the Intelligence Agents Information Act, and it made the publishing of the names of CIA agents illegal. But they were never able to successfully prosecute Ellen, and she held on with Bill for 27 years in exposing the crimes of the CIA. I think that what she did with respect to the assassination of John Kennedy was the most amazing. You know, when Kennedy was killed in November of 1963, the government's official story was that it was a lone assassin, this hapless guy named Lee Harvey Oswald. And they published a photograph of him in the newspaper, which I saw. I mean, all of us who were active then remember exactly what we were doing on November 22nd at 12 o'clock or whatever, you know,
right.
At that moment. We all remember that. And then the next day they published this picture of this guy, and he's standing there, and he's holding a socialist newspaper with his right hand. He's got a rifle holding with his left hand. He's got a pistol on his hip, and the sun is behind him. But there's a shadow that goes across his face. So we thought, either there were two suns in the sky that day, or this is a doctored picture and a phony story. So we were all suspicious, particularly Ellen Ray. So then Ellen...
And did she know Bill at that point?
In 63? No, I don't think so. But several years later, Jim Garrison, the district attorney of New Orleans, brought the only prosecution against anyone involved in the assassination of Kennedy. He prosecuted this New Orleans businessman named Clay Shaw, who was a CIA operative. So right away, if there are two people involved, it's by definition a conspiracy. But the government sabotaged his effort to prosecute Shaw, and Shaw was acquitted. But Ellen was given the manuscript of Garrison's book that he wrote about this.
That no one else would publish.
19 publishers refused to publish it. Ellen was then the president of Sheridan Square Press. She got Zach Sklar to edit the book, and it was published. I remember reading it when it came out, and it was amazing because we knew something was fishy, and Garrison demonstrated that. And then, because Ellen was anything if not bold, she cornered the famous director, Oliver Stone, in an elevator and got him to read the book and got him to make the movie JFK.
Amazing.
It's amazing. The movie won a couple of Oscars.
Right.
Starring
I think Kevin Costner played the DA.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And Tommy Lee Jones.
Right.
There are a bunch of famous actors in it. They did a beautiful job.
Didn't Ellen have a cameo in one of the versions?
I think she was in it, yeah, in a bar, I think, in New Orleans. And the movie succeeded in creating doubt across the country about the honesty of this government in its story about the assassination of Kennedy. Now we know, 50 years later, with a lot of scholarship, particularly James R. Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable. We interviewed Douglas on this
right.
show.
Great book.
We know now that indeed it was the CIA that killed Kennedy, and we know why.
Because he was going to forge peace.
Exactly.
Yeah.
He was trying to roll back the Cold War. He had developed back-channel communications with both Khrushchev and the Soviet Union and Castro. Mm-hmm. He had ordered the withdrawal of troops from Vietnam. He had already taken out 1,000, and he was going to take out the rest. He wanted to wind down the nuclear acceleration, and the CIA detested him. Of course, Kennedy detested the CIA. After the Bay of Pigs, he said he'd like to tear them up into 1,000 pieces and scatter them to the winds. So we now know what Ellen began to uncover, that indeed we have a powerful and really evil, to use Douglass's term, organization in this country that we have to live under. And that exposure was due to the great journalism of Ellen Ray.
And Michael, Mary Howell, a longtime Guild member from New Orleans, actually came up and spoke as well at Ellen's memorial, telling about how she and Bill were really beloved in that city.
Yeah. After Katrina, they went down and did legal work there, and the city was really on the edge. And they actually bought an apartment there to show their support and went down there and lived for many months each year. And then she told a funny story about, you know, they had this huge dog, an English sheepdog that weighed 180 pounds named Bamboo. And they have, I think it's called the Bacchus Parade, an animal parade in New Orleans every year. And they dressed up Bamboo as a streetcar, a New Orleans streetcar.
And Bill dressed up as the conductor, standing behind the dog. And if listeners want to actually read your wonderful talk, we're going to upload it to lawanddisorder.org, Michael.
Yeah, there's an outline on it, and we'll put it up.
Perfect. Michael Smith, we need to mention the fact that civil rights leader Julian Bond recently passed away. He was not only a founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, where he ultimately served as its director of communications, but he helped organize a sit-in with Atlanta college students in the City Hall cafeteria, served in the Georgia House of Representatives, and then served as president of the Southern Poverty Law Center.
And, you know, when he got elected to the House of Representatives, the other racist legislatures wouldn't let him take his seat.
That's right. And it went to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, so then so they had to call another election. Same thing happened.
Right.
And then it happened again three times before he finally got his seat. Because he opposed the war in Vietnam, they said he was guilty of dual loyalty.
Then he led a delegation to the Democratic National Convention, where his name was actually placed in nomination for a vice presidency, but he was too young at the time. Also, it's worth mentioning he was elected board chairman of the NAACP in 1998. He served there for 10 years, and Obama proclaimed him a hero and said in a statement that Julian Bond helped change this country for the better. I think it's worth noting that he was known for his gentlemanly qualities, even in really pressure cooker situations, volatile situations. He had a dignity and a calmness that people commented on for years as really being critical, as sort of a behind-the-scenes person. Also, Michael, just to mention, he was on the advisory board of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute, where I now work.
Not surprised.
Yeah. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Michael, we're delighted that we were able to get a copy of a recent talk you gave at the large Socialism 2015 conference in Chicago. It was called Different Ways to Skin a Cat, From the U.S. Assassination of Che to Obama's Recognition of Cuba.
I gave a talk last month, and I wanted to address the evolution of American policy towards Cuba because, you know, after the Cuban Revolution, when the 99% became the 1%, and the 1% went to Miami. The United States attempted successfully in isolating the Cuban country from the rest of Latin America and the world with the economic boycott, which still obtains. And they not only threw an economic blockade around Cuba, but they attempted to assassinate the leaders of the Cuban government. They overthrew any country in Latin America or in the Caribbean that supported the Cuban government, with the exception of Mexico, which had its own tradition. But they overthrew the governments of Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, and finally Chile in 1971. They were successful in completely isolating Cuba. Well, that has now been turned on its head. And the reason the American government, articulated by Obama, who said the policy has been a failure, is that the United States is now completely isolated in Latin America. And the last summit of the America conference in Panama, the Panamanian government told the United States, look, you don't have to come if you don't want to, but we're inviting Cuba. And that was the turning point, and the United States changed its policy. So now they're attempting to restore capitalist property relations and classes in Cuba, but in a different way. Now they're thinking they can do it by reintroducing capitalism to Cuba, and they're taking measures to try to do that. Will they succeed? We don't know.
Well, Michael Smith, let's go to your talk right now.
Lenny Bruce used to say, Chicago is so corrupt, it's thrilling. And I suppose it still is. Chicagoans be proud to know that one of the co-heads of the Chicago Mafia, Johnny Rosselli, attempted to assassinate Fidel Castro in 1962 with a poison pill. It was right out of a James Bond movie. Remember, they all had a nerdy guy from MI5 with all the gadgets that shows James Bond how to do it. His counterpart actually exists in the CIA, and he set up Rosselli with the pills. They got a guy in Miami to go to Havana to do it, but it didn't work. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of my story. What's really thrilling for me is to be at this conference. You walk in, that array of books in the book room is something like I've never seen. And the high level of discussion at these classes and the people that lead these classes, it's really quite extraordinary. So I'm pleased to be here, and I'm grateful to Ahmed Shawki and Sharon Smith and whoever else was involved in inviting me. And I want to talk about the book that I did with Michael Ratner, Who Killed Che? How the CIA Got Away with Murder. I'm actually from Chicago. My family was from Chicago. My grandfather set up a small tailor shop when he moved here from New York about 100 years ago. My mother was born in Chicago. I grew up in part in Chicago. And I went to school in the neighboring state of Wisconsin. 1960. Now, Wisconsin had its own Stephen Salida moment in 1894 when some businessmen of ill will, just like at the University of Illinois, decided that they wanted to get Professor Richard Ely fired. Ely was a socialist, he was an economist, and he made the mistake of supporting some workers in a struggle in a situation in Madison. The Board of Regents responded with a famous statement in Academic Freedom History. They said, whatever may be the limitations that trammel upon knowledge elsewhere, we at the great State University of Wisconsin shall forever encourage that fearless and courageous sifting and winnowing by which alone the truth may be found. So when I got to Wisconsin in 1960, which was still the 50s, and McCarthyism still prevailed, and Joe McCarthy came from Appleton, which is a town 70 miles north of Madison. When I got there, there were socialist professors. I had a socialist professor for economics. I had Harvey Goldberg, a socialist professor for history. I had a socialist professor for political science who gave me Isaac Deutscher to read. And I even had an atheist for geology. So my political consciousness as a socialist goes all the way back to the early days of the Cuban Revolution. And I would say, with that great sociologist C. Wright Mills, that I don't worry about Cuba. I worry for it and with it. The CIA was formed as a result of the National Security Act in 1947. The reason they set up the CIA was because the United States was not forewarned of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And they wanted an intelligence agency to gather intelligence and give it to the president. This all changed a year later in 1948 with NSA Memo 10-2, which was written by George Kennan, one of the architects of the Cold War. Kennan was to later regret having done that, said it was the biggest mistake of his life. And the reason he said that was is that NSA Memo 10-92 allowed for the CIA to do all these illegal things. But because they were illegal, they had to invent a way to dodge responsibility for it and not get the executive blamed for it. So they came up with the doctrine of plausible deniability, which is an Orwellian term which combines lying and hypocrisy. When Richard Helms was asked by the Church Committee in 1975, Helms had been the director of operations when Shea was killed. He later became the head of the CIA. They wrote a book about him called The Man Who Kept His Secrets. And Helms was asked, well, did you ever discuss assassinations with the president? And Helms said, no, never. Why would we want to embarrass the president? So the way it operated was that the CIA would be given kind of a general understanding of what the president wanted to do, but not the details to protect the president. As a consequence, between 1948 and 1967, the year Che was assassinated, between 1948 and 1947, the year Che was assassinated, the CIA had assassinated or attempted to assassinate 19 leaders of foreign countries, including Patrice Lumumba, whose body was driven around in the trunk of a CIA agent's car for 3 days, Diem in Vietnam, Sukarno, the head of Iraq. It's all cataloged in our book, Who Killed Che? This book is the culmination of really an 18-year project of Michael Ratner and myself. In 1997, when Michael was the legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, we were walking down the street in Greenwich Village, and he said to me, Michael said, you know, I got these two huge boxes of documents in the mail today, and I'm not sure what to do with them. He had used the Freedom of Information Act to request of the CIA and the FBI and the Department of Defense and the White House all their records on Che Guevara. So Michael got these two huge boxes of documents. They were mostly from the FBI, but also the FBI was on the CC list of the rest of the outfit. So we got a bunch of documents. And so what do you think we should do with them? I said, I don't know. At the time, I was representing Ocean Press. Ocean Press is all proportions guarded, like Haymarket. Comes out of Australia, and they publish stuff about Cuba and socialism. So I emailed Ocean Press, and they said, we're very interested. We're stopping production of our catalog to get an idea of what you guys have. So my wife Debbie and Michael and I went through these two huge boxes of documents, and we sent them what we thought would be of interest, and they published it. Well, the book is called Che Guevara and the FBI, the American Secret Police Dossier on the Latin American Revolutionary. And frankly, it's, you know, it's not that great. There's one part of it that Michael always likes to cite, which is amusing, and I'll share with you. When Che was fighting the Serra Maestras, the CIA sent an agent to spy on him. We later found out who the agent was. He just died a few months ago. He was the editor of the Washington, he became the editor of the Washington Post, Arnav Dobroshkov. But at that time, he was just starting out his career, and the little weasel got into Che's camp, and he actually slept in Che's tent for a week. And he wrote the CIA the following. He said, he smells. He smokes long cigars. Every night, he reads to his troops. This week, he was reading the French novelist Daudet. He seems fairly intelligent for a Latino. Che was only a half a generation older than me and those of us who were radicalized in the 60s. So the things that radicalized us really affected him. I mean, I had a fantasy last night about Che. See, if Che hadn't been killed, he'd only be 87 years old. He could still be alive. And he could see that brochure on our conference, International Socialist Organization. International Socialist, that's me. I don't think the U.S. would give him a visa, but he could have come to this conference. He was like a 50s and a half radical. For us, Che was a symbol of boldness, intelligence, self-sacrifice, solidarity, and as he himself said, quote, at the risk of sounding ridiculous, motivated by feelings of love. Che's parents were kind of this offbeat Argentinian aristocrats who had more blue blood than money. His parents eloped when his mother, Cecilia, was 3 months pregnant. They ran a bohemian household. Che was the oldest of five children. There were no set meal times. There were books and magazines scattered all over the living room. People would come in at any hour to drink red wine and discuss stuff. His parents were political. They were anti-fascists. Che denounced a fascist professor when he was at the university. They were atheists. Che organized a soccer team of the children in the neighborhood. The atheists on one team and the believers on the other. And Che's team invariably lost because they were always the smallest. When Che was 2 years old, he developed terrible asthmatic condition, and his parents had to move to the provinces to higher altitudes for his health. So he was pretty much homeschooled. Tell that to the right wing. And the folks did a pretty good job of it. Jean-Paul Sartre said that he was the most complete man of the 20th century. Che said that he wanted to go to medical school. He said, quote, I dreamed of becoming a famous investigator, of working indefatigably to find something that could be definitively placed at the disposition of humanity. Because of his asthma, he was rejected by the draft. So the great warrior of the Cuban Revolution was found to have diminished physical abilities. Che told his friends that he, quote, thanked his lungs for doing something useful for a change. In his teens, Che wrote poetry and five philosophical notebooks. He read assiduously. He kept an index of the literature he had been reading by author, nationality, title, and genre. He had an extraordinary capacity for learning. He read his father's entire 25-volume history of the modern world. He read Jules Verne, Freud, Bertrand Russell, Aldous Huxley, Mussolini, Stalin, Zola, Jack London, and Lenin. He read the Communist Manifesto. He dipped into Das Kapital. He wrote a long piece on Marx's life and works. He wrote a portrait of Lenin, whom he appreciated as a person who, quote, lived, breathed, and slept socialist revolution. Che got a summer job when he was in high school as a merchant mariner. He shipped out around the world and rubbed shoulders with all sorts of people. He traveled a lot, and he kept a journal. And that habit of traveling and keeping a journal became a lifelong habit. You all probably remember the Motorcycle Diaries. It was his journal. They made it into a movie. In that odyssey, he and his friend Alberto Granado took a 500cc Norton all around Argentina and Chile and Bolivia. He visited the copper mines in Chile. He visited the tin mines in Bolivia. And with his characteristic caustic tongue, Che commented that, quote, that the Yankees have taken everything and left the native people only an ox. For Che, the road to Cuba went through Guatemala. The Guatemalan people had elected a reformer president named Jacobo Arbenz. In 1954, the CIA overthrew Arbenz. Che, after graduating medical school, had gone to Guatemala looking for a job as a doctor. Arbenz made the mistake of stepping on part of corporate America's toes, the United Fruit Company, by nationalizing some of the fallow land of the United Fruit Company. The CIA came in to the rescue of the United Fruit Company. They recruited a furniture salesman named Castillo Armas, who had been an ex-colonel, And they had the guy trained in nearby Nicaragua under Somoza. Not the original Somoza. The original Somoza in the 30s was a bastard. FDR said, he may be a bastard, but he's our bastard. His kid was the same. And his kid helped the CIA. They trained Armas. Armas came into Guatemala. There was little resistance. Arbenz was overthrown. Che tried to organize resistance. It didn't work out. And he fled to Mexico City. And he took with him three truths and a new female companion named Hilda Gadea. Hilda Gadea was much more politically advanced than Che. She was a Peruvian Marxist, and Che learned a lot from her. Same way that Trotsky learned from his first wife. And I thought, you know, I bet you that's true a lot. And that would be a good article for the ISR magazine. But in any case, Che took with him Hilda Gadea and three truths. And the three truths that he took with him from Guatemala are that the vast land holdings have to be broken up, that the land has to be given to the peasants who fought for it, and they have to be armed so they can protect what they've gained. And the old ruling class, the old ruling elite's repressive apparatus has to be dismantled. When Che got to Mexico City, he met up with Nico Lopez. He had known Nico Lopez in Guatemala. Nico Lopez was a veteran of the Moncada attack. In 1953, Fidel organized a group of mostly students to attack the Moncada barracks, where Batista, the dictator, had his headquarters. Batista barely escaped through a hidden door in the back of his office. But the students that attacked Moncada suffered very badly. Most of them were captured, tortured, killed. Fidel himself was tried. That was the occasion of his famous Let History Will Absolve Me speech, which is on the internet and which I recommend. He was put in jail, and Nico Lopez got out of there. He escaped, and he met up with Che again in Mexico City. It was Nico Lopez that introduced Che to Fidel. After meeting Fidel, Che described him as, quote, a young man, intelligent, very sure of himself, and of extraordinary audacity. I think there's a mutual sympathy between us. They went out for dinner. They talked for hours. And Fidel invited Che to join his guerrilla movement. Che accepted on the spot. He was the third person to do so. The other was Raul Castro, Fidel's younger brother. Che wrote, quote, the truth is that after the experiences of my wanderings across all of Latin America, and to top it off in Guatemala, it didn't take much to incite me to join any revolution against a tyrant. But Fidel impressed me as an extraordinary man. He faced and overcame the most impossible things. He had an exceptional faith in that once he left for Cuba, he would arrive. And once he arrived, he would fight. And that fighting, he would win. I shared his optimism. It was time to stop crying and fight. So Fidel had accumulated 82 supporters. They took a boat. You couldn't even describe it as a ship. The difference between a boat and a ship is that a boat can go on a ship. And those of us who have been to Cuba have seen this boat called Granma. How many people have ever been to Cuba? You know, it's right there in downtown. You know, the thing could fit in this room. It had 82 people on it. Well, they arrived in Cuba a day late and a dollar short. They landed in the wrong place. They'd been observed by one of Batista's naval boats. Batista organized an ambush. Most of the people were killed. 22 escaped. And there's an apocryphal story about Che hiding in this mangrove grove under machine gun fire. And he had a choice of either picking up his medical bag, you know, because he was supposed to be the troops' doctor, or picking up an ammunition bag. And the story goes that he picked up the ammunition bag. His skills as a warrior were soon recognized, and he was promoted to commandante. He became Fidel's chief confidant and de facto military chief of staff. He fought alongside a woman named Elena March. They were later to get together. They had two sons and two daughters. The most well-known is Aladita, Che's daughter, who's a dead ringer for Che. She's a pediatrician. Che's father was brimming with admiration for his son, and he told a radio reporter, how busy Che was. He had laid the basis for agrarian reform in the Sierra, built an arms factory, invented a bazooka rifle, inaugurated the first bread factory in the mountains, built and equipped a hospital, created the first school, and installed a radio transmitter called Radio Rebel Day. And he still had time left to found a small newspaper to inform the rebel troops. By the end of 1958, Che, teaming up with Camilo Cienfuegos, led a military column in the middle of the country in a city called Santa Clara. And they captured an arms train. They captured the city, and they cut the island in half. And that was all she wrote for Batista, who got on an airplane to the Dominican Republic. The Fidel's troops marched into Havana on the 8th of January of 1959. The march into Havana coincided with a mass general strike, with a mass uprising of the peasants in the countryside. Fidel went into the Hilton Hotel. They changed the name to the, it was called the Havana Hilton, and now it's called Havana Libre. And I was thinking we should call this the Hyatt Libre. And it all started. The first thing they did was pass a law lowering the age so that Fidel could be premier. He was 32 years old, so they lowered the age from 35 to 30. Second law gave Che honorary citizenship of Cuba. The third law was the Great Agrarian Reform Law. Che drafted that law and the organization that was to implement it. And they told the Americans who owned most of the land, it's our right under international law to nationalize this land. And we'll pay you for it. And we will pay you the amount that you've listed for tax purposes on what you pay us. Americans didn't like that. They owned the oil refinery. They stopped refining Cuban oil so that the economy would grind to a halt. The Cubans nationalized the oil refinery. Then they nationalized the phone company. Then they nationalized the nickel mines, and so on and so on. That became the Cuban Revolution. On April 6, 1960, barely a year after the victory, Assistant Secretary of State Lester Molloy drafted a wicked memorandum declassified years later indicating that, quote, I'm going to read you from the memorandum. The majority of Cubans support Castro. An effective political opposition does not exist. The only foreseeable means of alienating internal support to the government is through disenchantment and disaffection based on economic dissatisfaction and hardship. To weaken the economic life of Cuba, denying it money and supplies, to decrease monetary and real wages, to bring about hunger, desperation, and overthrow the government. That was, and in a way remains, American policy towards Cuba now. The only difference is instead of trying to overthrow the government by these means, they're trying to do it by the embrace of capitalism. The Cubans are very aware of this danger. Che became head of Cuba's National Bank. The story that I like to tell about that is that all the leadership were sitting around a table, and Fidel said, who knows something about economics, economista? And Che raised his hand. So they made him head of the bank. And later on, one of the comrades came over to Che and they said, you know about economics? And Che said, no, I thought he said comunista. He wrote, I got 10 minutes left. I may go 5 minutes over, is that okay? He wrote a classic manual on guerrilla warfare. That manual was read on both sides of the class lines. JFK read that manual, and it was given to American counterinsurgency troops. Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev's advisor said that the predominant group in the senior circles of the Soviet Central Committee detested Che, who they saw as dangerous, as against our strategy. And he said, even though Che was against our interests, there was still some sympathy for him. There was a romantic aura around him. He reminded people of the Russian Revolution. Opinion was divided. Some compared him to Trotsky. Well, after that speech, Che dropped out of sight. He showed up in the Belgian Congo, which was hoping to be the Congo, independent of Belgium. But despite his support there, the Congolese rebel leadership remained disorganized and uncooperative. When his mission in the Congo failed, he next went to Bolivia. There was much speculation about where he was, but the CIA really didn't know. Why did Che and the Cuban Communist Party choose Bolivia? Bolivia was the first most unstable country and all of Latin America. It had had 189 different governments since it was formed in 1825. The new government had just been installed by the CIA, General Barrientos. Barrientos had been trained at the School of the Americas, as had 21 of his 23 generals. The School of the Americas was known as the Escuela de Escolpes, a coup school. And Barrientos was their man in Bolivia, but the army in Bolivia was terrible. They didn't even have any intelligence in the army. So they thought that if they went to Bolivia, Bolivia and the Andes would be like the Sierra Maestras, that the spine of the Andes would be a way to get a foothold, that they could win the revolution and spark it with the guerrilla warfare in Bolivia, and then it would spread to Argentina, which was Che's main target, and Chile and Bolivia and Brazil and so on. And that was their theory. It was the same hope that Lenin and Trotsky and the Bolsheviks had after the Russian Revolution, that they'd get a toehold in Russia, but unless the revolution spread to Europe, especially to Germany, it would go under. Soviet Premier Kosygin learned that Che was in Bolivia. He was crazed. He flew to Havana, and he confronted Fidel. And they must have had a microphone in the wall, because we have this report of the conversation. Kosygin said to Fidel, "How dare you not tell me that Che is in Bolivia doing what he's doing? And what you're doing there is upsetting our whole plans for socialism in Latin America." And Fidel said, "Now let me tell you something. I don't agree with your premise. I don't think you have plans for socialism in South America." Well, the whole operation in Bolivia, when you read it, reads like a tragedy. Che got there in November of 66. By March, it was all over. By March, there were two defectors from Che's troop. Troop was about 30 people or so, and they had connections in La Paz. The CIA quickly liquidated the connections in La Paz. The two defectors were picked up immediately. The CIA learned about it. They told the White House. The White House organized this whole operation. The chief counter-revolutionary in the White House in charge of this was a guy named Walt Whitman Rostow. His parents were radicals. His brother was Eugene Victor Debs Rostow. He also was a liberal. His parents must have been disappointed. So they dispatched a General Porter, who was the head of the Southern Command, to Bolivia. And they sent the head of intelligence from the Southern Command, another general. And they sent another general who was the head of the Air Force. And they kept the military going down there. And a month later, they drafted a contract called a Memorandum of Understanding. And the contract said, "Bolivia, you produce 600 men and a piece of property where we can train them on, and we'll do the rest." So the Americans supplied the Bolivians with everything from breakfast to bullets. They trained them. They gave themselves, the CIA was going to be the intelligence arm of this Bolivian battalion. They also sent two CIA contract agents to meet with Barrientos. Gustavo Villaldo got off the plane in La Paz and was driven to Barrientos' palace. Villaldo was like the main CIA guy. Rodriguez was the second guy. And Villaldo said to him, "If you capture Che, we want him killed." And Barrientos said to Villaldo, "I give you my word as the president of Bolivia that if we capture him, we will kill him." So there was a prior agreement. The battalion was trained. Two people that were working with Che, Régis Debray, a French intellectual, had written a book, Revolution in the Revolution, which kind of codified Che's notion of guerrilla warfare. And he was with another guy named Ciro Bustos, who was an Argentinian artist who Che had hoped would set up stuff in Argentina. And the two of them visited Che in his camp. They left. They thought, if anybody picks us up, we'll just tell them we're journalists. Well, it didn't work. They were picked up. They were tortured. Bustos, being an artist, was able to draw portraits of all the people, including Che. We have in the documents that we published a memo on White House stationery from Rostow to Lyndon Johnson saying, "We now have confirmed that Che Guevara is active in Bolivia." I'm going to conclude with what happened to Che. Things went from bad to worse. He was totally isolated. Rodriguez set up the intelligence unit. They captured somebody from Che's troop, and they found out from him that there was always somebody 1,000 meters in advance of Che's troop. Well, they captured that person, so they were able to locate exactly where Che's troop was. They surrounded Che in a canyon. He was captured, taken back to the little village of La Higuera. He was bound hand and foot. He was kept overnight in one room mud schoolhouse. Rodriguez had a shortwave radio. They had worked out a prior code. 0700 meant Shay. 0800 meant spare him. 0900 meant kill him. Rodriguez cranked up the radio, got a hold of the generals in Bolivia, in La Paz. They corresponded back and they said 0900. Rodriguez said that he was the highest, he was dressed up as an army captain in the Bolivian army. He said he was the highest ranking soldier on the scene and he could have countermanded the order, but he didn't want to do it, he said, because he remembered that Batista let Fidel out of prison and that was a mistake. So he allowed Che, he says, he allowed Che to be killed, but it was really the Bolivians that did it. That was the American cover story all along till we published this book, that it was the Bolivians that did it. Bolivian Army Sergeant, I'm going to conclude with what happened and how Che was killed. Bolivian Army Sergeant Mario Terran drew the short straw and was assigned a duty. He entered the schoolhouse. Che stood up. Terran said, sit down. Che said, I will remain standing for this. Terran then lost his nerve and he fled the schoolroom. He fortified himself with a couple of drinks and he returned. Che again stood up. Terran closed his eyes and he squeezed off a round of shots on his automatic rifle. The bullet struck Che across the chest, entered his lungs, filled his lungs with blood, and he died. Villaldo and Rodriguez tied Che's body to the strut of a helicopter and flew him to the town of Villa Grande. Then Che's body was put on display to the press on a cement slab in the basement of the hospital there. And there's a photograph, I think many of you have seen it, of Che's corpse, Christ-like, with Villaldo standing behind him. Che's hands were sawed off, bagged, and flown to the CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, for confirmation. His prints were confirmed with the help of the Argentinian government. Walt Whitman Rostow wrote in a memorandum to Lyndon Johnson on White House stationery, which we published, and the memorandum stated, the troops that we trained finally got him. I want to conclude with something that Victor Hugo wrote about Jean-Paul Marat, who was also a doctor and a leader of the French Revolution. They guillotined Charlotte Corday and they said, Marat is dead. No, Marat is not dead. Put him in the Pantheon or throw him in the sewer, it doesn't matter. He's back the next day. He's reborn in the man who has no job, the woman who has no bread, and the girl who has to sell her body, and the child who hasn't learned to read. He's reborn in the unheated tenement, in the wretched mattress without blankets, in the unemployed, in the proletariat, in the brothel, in the jailhouse, in your laws that show no pity, in your schools that give no future. And he appears in all that is ignorance, and he recreates himself from all that is darkness. Oh, beware, human society, you cannot kill Marat until you have killed the misery of poverty. Thank you.
That was our own Michael Smith speaking on July 2nd at the Socialism Conference in Chicago.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.